Literature, Richard said, describes a descent. First gods, then demigods, then epic became tragedy, failed kings, failed heroes, then the gentry, then the middle class and its mercantile dreams. Then it was about you, social realism. Then it was about them, lowlife, villains, the ironic age. And Richard was saying, now what? Literature, for a while, can be about us, i.e. writers, but that won't last long. How do we burst clear of all this? And he asked them, whither the novel?
Writer Martin Amis, he'll be back in just a moment with more from his new book, a novel entitled The Information. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Stories about midlife crises aren't unusual in contemporary fiction, but in his new novel, Martin Amis provides some fresh perspectives on middle-age angst. The Information is a darkly comic account of celebrity and literary envy. It's the story of two friends, Richard Tull and Gwyn Berry, set against the backdrop of publishing and pop culture in modern-day London. It's also a book about the male ego, social violence, the decline of literary fiction, and the destruction of innocence. With an excerpt from his new book, here is Martin Amis.
Outside there hung the crescent moon. It looked like punch, but where was Judy? Fly a mile east in our weep ship to the spires of Holland Park, the aerials, the house, the layered roof, the burglar alarms, the first floor window thick with reflections, looming over the still garden. This is the window to the master bedroom where the master sleeps. I'm not going in there, not yet. So I don't know what his bed smells of, and I don't know if he cries in the night, as Richard does. Why do the men cry? Because of fights and feats and marathon preferment, because they want their mothers, because they're blind in time, because of all the hard-ons they have to whistle up out of the thin blue yonder, because of all that men have done, because they can't be happy or sad anymore, only smashed or nuts, and because they don't know how to do it when they're awake. And then there is the information which comes at night.
Martin Amis, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Tell us about what happens in The Information.
Well, it's a novel about writers, which is kind of a rash move since, as I say, you know, nothing ever happens to writers, particularly novelists. They're just grinders who sit at home all day. But nonetheless, I managed to, you know, supply some incident. It's about the rivalry between two old friends, two writers. One is fantastically unsuccessful, indeed can't get published anymore, but persists in, you know, quietly, heroically writing these unreadable, modernistic, difficult books, you know, books that are like 500-page crossword clues, whereas his much less talented or even more talentless colleague, Gwyn, has sort of lucked out in the most disgraceful and unforgivable way with a kind of new age, bland, utopian novel called Ameliore, where every nation and every, you know, there are 12 men, 12 women, every nation represented. It's a sort of feel-good book, or not feel-bad book, in that all it does is strive not to give offense to anyone.
Do you know these characters, Martin? How do you invent these people without and still go ahead and live your life in the real world and face your friends who aren't going to accuse you of lampooning them and what they do in literary circles?
No, I have had no trouble from my friends. I would never be interested in writing any kind of roman à clé. You know, to spend 5 years in your study dumping on your friends seems to me the depth of frivolity. Right. Now, what I do is, you know, I'm someone said of my work that I deal in banalities rendered with tremendous force. I'm quite happy with that description. So once I'd established that one of the writers was going to be, you know, unbearably unsuccessful and painfully unsuccessful. I mean, when he does get his book published, he ends up with a readership of one person. Mm-hmm. Not even the publishers can read it.
He calls the bookstore to find out if any books have been sold. It's so depressing.
It's very depressing, but also, I think, very comic when you then contrast it with the ridiculous success of his friend. Mm-hmm. And once you've pushed two characters so far apart, you know, the contrast is so extreme, then that's where, you know, comedy, I find, exists, is mm-hmm. in between vast extremes, rubbed up close together.
Well, let's take it for what you're presenting it to us as, that is to say, fiction. It nonetheless represents a deeply bitter, sarcastic and comic commentary on the state of modern letters. As you say, the successful novelist here is an airhead, never had a serious thought, and yet he's making all sorts of money. He is a candidate for, what do you call it, this marvelous award, the Profundity Requital? Tell us about that.
Well, that's just a joke on the Genius Award, which I always thought was a hilarious vulgarism. The idea that you're being sort of duly rewarded for your profundity.
Every year until you die, you're going to get a big, big check.
Big check. Yes, the Gwynne's success is certainly a criticism of the culture. This, you know, Tom Wolfe called, was it the 60s or the 70s, the me decade?
I guess it would have been the 70s leading up into the 80s. That's right. The bonfire of the vanities, right?
Right. But every decade is the me decade. And, you know, the decades are ridiculously arbitrary anyway. It's not as if on the 1st of January the population decides it's going to be something else this
right.
decade. But this decade, the 90s, is the me decade in the sense that, you know, everyone is fired up about their own needs. And any sort of attempt to look at literature with reasonable impartiality is gone. That's not no one's interested in that now. You know, the thing is, how does this react with me? And it becomes a kind of, you know, self-help, kind of therapeutic process.
Well, not only that, but, I mean, you inject the element of celebrity here. I mean, you put these two guys on a book tour. You have your talentless novelist on a book tour, and his friend, who's the guy who's the real artist, so to speak, it has to write about him and do this sort of fawning piece.
Yeah, that's a sort of, the world arranges, you know, every humiliation that's available for for Richard Tull.
Right.
And his attempts to ruin his friend are rather like those of Wiley Coyote trying to...
the American gets cartoon.
Gets flattened right. every time. But, yes, I'm definitely saying that, you know, Richard's neglected work is very sort of hard-edged, and it's the bland stuff that's tending now to get the big readership.
Tell us about the women in this book, Martin Amis. You have Richard's wife, whose name is Gina, and then you have Gwynne, the airhead novelist, who's married to this fabulously beautiful, wealthy relative of the Queen. And
that's just pushing the extremes to, you know, ridiculous extent. The women are being criticized in this book for, you know, not being bigger characters. And actually, when the book was forming in my head, I thought perhaps I better have a sort of poetess in there or something. And then I thought, no, why am I bussing in these chicks for this book? you know, like positive discrimination. the truth is that it's a book about the male ego, and in my experience, and I think, you know, throughout history, the women of writers' women have tended to be diminished figures, that male artists do suck life out of those around them in some kind of vampiric way. And, you know, they are kind of shadowy. But
you do have a culture of violence, and you have characters in this book who stand in sort of counterpoint to the niceties of the literary world. Richard, for example, your lead character, gets involved with some of the London lowlifes, and with unexpected results. He thinks he's going to get one thing, but the bad guys, in effect, deliver something else.
Yeah, it's a I thought a great triumph of comic literalism that in all his efforts to ruin his friend, what can he do? Can he write a hostile profile? Can he even frame him on a plagiarism charge?
Right.
But he says, no, what I'm going to do is pay someone to beat him up.
Mm-hmm. And then you get identities mixed.
Yeah. And of course, like everything else, it backfires. And towards the very end seems to backfire in the most, sickening way possible, where his own child is endangered.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a very simple message there, which is, don't slum with violence. Don't summon up those forces, because they will rebound on you.
Let's talk, come back for a moment, Martin Amis, to the American Book Tour here. You've got some pretty sharp things to say about those of us who live in the United States of America. Do you like this culture, essentially? Do you enjoy being here? Or is it, some of the darker moments of the satire here, pretty bitter? How about it?
Well, no, I mean, I regard myself as sort of half American as a writer, certainly as a North Atlantic writer. I spent some time here growing up as a child, and I think my last 5-6 novels have had very strong American settings or characters. Mm-hmm.
But not anti-American.
No, not at all. I mean, it's ridiculous to be anti-American. It's like being anti the planet. I mean, America is more like a world than a country. It's all here. And, you can't be anti it.
Well, you've got some wonderful lines in this book. You say that airports in America, maybe this is global, they are places of what? Landscapes that are incomplete. A few words, but bingo, you get it right between the crosshairs here. And then the American obsession with telephones and TVs and celebrity.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's plenty to criticize here. And in other novels, there's plenty to praise. I can't have an attitude towards America, because America is much too complicated. It changes every 100 miles.
Right.
You're in another country.
You say that America is like a world or a planet unto itself. Part of the perspective, one of the serious sort of structural issues that you're playing with, not playing with, but working very hard at and successfully, I might add, in this novel, is this question of perspective, moving from the galactic down to the postage stamp. How did you put all of that together, which is to say ego, individual, the one and the many, and you put it in cosmic terms, no less?
Well, it really came from a play on words, in that it strikes me more and more that what marks out talent in fiction is its universality, that, what the novelist is doing all day is confessing to certain truths about himself that turn out to have some kind of application for everyone.
And yet, aren't you lampooning that in a way, because the success of the talentless novel is his universal appeal?
Yes, but that's a kind of programmatic universality. And it's,
that's phony multiculturalism.
Yeah, and it's unfelt. It's, even my most sordid characters, who always turn out to be the most popular of my, creations, they're popular because everyone has, is 1% that,
Didn't you say at some point, I read in a review that you got 3% of your very own physical Martin Amis self in some of these bad characters?
Yeah, and then what you do is you get that 3% and then you abolish the other 97% while you're writing the book. So thoughts about universality then go out to considering, the insignificance of the planet. Uh-huh. in cosmic terms. And I think there's going to be a kind of revolution in consciousness about the discoveries of this century.
Well, in this sense, your book is a kind of an environmental statement. I don't mean some heavy-handed tract, but it makes that case at one level, doesn't it?
Well, it's environmental in, it's green in the head is where I'm pointing. Hmm. In that, just as you could argue that the Renaissance was partly powered by Copernicus and Galileo, who told us something we didn't know about ourselves, that in fact the Earth revolved around the Sun and not vice versa. Uh-huh. I mean, all one's ancestors believed otherwise. And it sounds like a depressing bit of news to be demoted from the center of the universe, but in fact, it's hugely energizing.
Uh-huh.
And
well, that's what's happening to the writers in this book, too. Isn't
yeah.
It? They're being demoted from the center of their own universe.
Exactly. But the discoveries of Edwin Hubble in this century and the discoveries from the Hubble, new Hubble telescope, are demoting us further and further and further. And philosophy of science is telling us that that actually this is only one universe among an infinity of other universes.
Mm-hmm.
So we shrink and shrink. But this isn't depressing news. This is thrilling news.
And liberating.
If it's the case, it's very liberating.
Let's talk about the literary universe, Martin Amis. Again, you have great fun with the isms and the trends, the deconstructionists, the theorists, the people who do literary fiction, the people who do popular fiction. How long now have we been experiencing the death of the novel? And that's a theme that runs through your book. Tell us about that.
Well, you keep hearing about it, the death of the novel, and, you know, the curtains are drawn in the emergency room every few years, and then the very next morning you go in there and the novel is sitting up in bed and drinking some hot broth and feeling very much better. It's a young form, but we keep on hearing about how, you know, it's reached a decrepit state.
Well, then why do you make, if I hear some optimism there, why do you make your character Richard Tull the author of something called The History of Increasing Humiliation, as well as a book called Untitled, which spells the death of serious literary fiction?
Well, it does for him, because there are a couple of things wrong with him as a writer. The essential one being that he doesn't love his readers. I think you don't just want to entertain the reader. You know, Dryden said that literature gives instruction and delight. And I think the emphasis these days very much is on delight and should be on delight. But instruction, you want to sneak in instruction there. And you also want to open their senses, open their thoughts and perceptions.
You want to shock your readers, for example? I mean, with some of the more extreme episodes in this book and the information?
Yeah, but not for the sake of it. You also want to kind of torture the reader as well. I mean, there's sadism is involved as well. It's
getting back.
A bit of rough stuff with the reader every now and then is good. But it's a pleasure principle thing that, you know, I write the novels I want to read, and my best readers are, you know, feel the same way, that these are written especially for them.
You say at one point in the information, Martin Amis, that writing is, what is it, denial? It's the largest form of denial. Will you unpack that one?
Yeah, I mean, this is a book about the midlife crisis, and the information is, of the title, is essentially the information that you're going to die, which is never quite clear to you while you still have the, you know, the aura of youth about you. Once the youth has evaporated, you suddenly realize that you really are. It's not just the rumor.
Right. This is social, it's genetic, it's cultural.
It's everything.
Crowds in on you.
I think it does. And, you know, even a writer as apparently haughty as Nabokov, for instance, I feel convinced, you know, deeply committed to the pleasure principle, to the idea that delighting the reader is the writer's greatest pleasure. You know, Richard is a maroon modernist. He wrote very difficult novels of the kind we used to like. You remember 30, 40 years ago, Lionel Trilling saying, "We like difficult books."
Uh-huh. There was a kind of collective spokesperson going on there, and that we don't have that sense anymore.
We don't anymore. There's not that kind of consensus about what we like anymore, but I can answer Lionel by saying we don't like difficult books, not anymore. We like, you know, we like to be challenged a certain amount, but it's as if life itself is, you know, too difficult. We
taking
don't want
the
to
edges
come,
off of it.
We don't want to come home and curl up with Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Martin Amis, let's talk. We're discussing your novel, The Information. Tell me about your life as a sort of cultural journalist.
Well, I write journalism, you know, the peripatetic journalism, to get out of the house, basically, because otherwise I don't get out of the house.
That's what Richard Tull wants to do, isn't
exactly.
it?
I mean, novels are all about not getting out of the house, and
indeed,
that's what they involve. Uh-huh. So journalism takes me to you know, America and to China, indeed.
The tennis matches?
Tennis matches. You indulge your interests and hobbies, and it does sort of feed back into the fiction eventually. But I find it's like writing left-handed. It's very awkward, difficult, compromised stuff.
So your favorite activity is the novelistic, the fictional stuff?
Yeah. I wake up feeling, you know, full of eagerness to get on with that. But if I'm writing journalism, and if I'm running a book review, which I think is the most sort of killing of all journalistic form.
This is why you make Richard your character, your hero. I don't know if he's a hero, but you give him these incredible titles of biographies to review.
Tons of you know, exocets of
verbiage.
Boredom are sent to him in jiffy bags. The book review, I think, is, you know, something of an art form and extremely difficult to get right. Reporting journalism is freer than that. But what the difference being that when you're writing fiction, you're in godlike relation to what you create. There are no limitations whatever. Whereas with journalism, it's a specific length, specific audience, specific date, etc. But more essentially, you're at the mercy of what happens to you on these things. If you go to see John Updike, you're at the mercy of how it goes with John Updike.
Martin Amis, I can't let you get away without trying to pry a little bit here about literary gossip, literary scandal, that is to say, how much one gets paid to publish and distribute and publicize a book. And I suppose that is just part of our cultural diet. We want to hear these stories, as it were, from the horse's mouth. How do you, for example, these stories about these massive advances that you got for this book that we've been discussing, The Information, and the literary feuds, how do you want people who listen to a conversation like this to understand that in the sort of larger picture of what you're doing as a writer and an artist?
Well, it's just a huge distraction, and you know, it showed me a lot of things about England. It actually sort of terrified me about England, and made me reproach myself for not realizing what a fierce and mean town London is.
So who's got the high ground here on literary viciousness? The Americans or the Brits?
Brits. Americans don't mind you getting a big advance. That's what, you know, everyone's trying to do, isn't it?
Sure. My basketball players, look what we pay them.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, America is a money society, and England is still a class society. So, you know, money is just how you measure your life performance, and no one resents that in America. In England, it turns out that you know, whereas no one minds a writer getting $5 million for obvious crap, like Jeffrey Archer. They mind.
£800,000 to him is what? Something that we need to round out.
Exactly.
Isn't that what one of the reviews said?
Yeah. But once you get it for a serious novel or a literary novel, then in England, the nature of the Philistinism in England is that they think that writers, serious writers, are kind of tolerated joke, you know. They manage to con some people into buying their books. You know, some people take them seriously. But when they start looking like financial players as well, then they just, you know, really can't take it.
The real world.
I should stress that this isn't, I'm not talking about other novelists. I mean, with the exception of A.S. Byatt, who is, I think just sort of discreet and indiscreet and garrulous, I don't think there was any other writer in England who minded me getting that money. It was only the journalists that minded.
Writer Martin Amis. His new novel is The Information, available from Vintage Books. Martin Amis is also the author of Money, Dead Babies, and Visiting Mrs. Nabokov and Other Excursions. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment to tell you where to write for a cassette tape of this week's show. Before that, however, here again is Martin Amis with another excerpt from his new novel, The Information.
Now came half term, with the children home all day, and Richard's week of sole charge. It was a time of great revelations. It was a time of ceaseless discovery. Who would have thought it? In a scant 5 days, while he went about his simple tasks in the company of those two young souls, more genuine illumination came his way than in as many years of cloistered endeavor. bent over his books and all their fuss and dust. By mid-morning on Tuesday, Richard knew why women never did anything and were no good at anything and never amounted to anything and never contributed anything permanent, that is to say. It wasn't having children that did it, necessarily. It was hanging out with children that did it. Whatever you thought of this arrangement, it had something to be said in its favor. It demanded no further inquiry, and it wouldn't be getting any, not from him. Why waste valuable time when you could be untangling a shoelace, or picking up crumbs, or tripping over a squeaky toy, or slapping some slice of Trex onto a frying pan, or going down on your hands and knees to search for a weapon component under the sofa, or the bunk bed, or the oven? His wife Gina came home at 6. Richard went into his study and began his review of A New Life of Warwick Deeping. After 40 minutes, he had something like, "This is a long book. This book has pictures. I like pictures. Pictures are good. There is a picture of a man. There is a picture of a house. There is a picture of a lady. You have to read pages, but you don't have to read pictures. I like pictures because pictures are good."
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Audio cassettes are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to us at Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 819. That's $10, program number 819. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. If you'd like to have more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonpartisan, and nonprofit institute that seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, to strengthen teaching, and to broaden public understanding of the humanities. Next week on Soundings, award-winning poets Betty Adcock and Kathleen Aguero will be here to read from and talk about their work. Betty Adcock's new collection of poems is The Difficult Wheel. Kathleen Aguero is the author of a collection entitled The Real Weather. Until next week's show, this is Wayne Pond. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.